disengage ourselves, engage in meditation, and achieve the rapture condition of nirvanic harmony. There was an early form of Buddhism where this escape from life was taken seriously. The Buddhism of the doctrine of the ancients. It's also known as the Hinayana Buddhism, the little ferry boat Buddhism. Because in order to follow this Buddhism, you must give up the world and step into the little monk ferry boat that will carry you to the yonder shore. During the first century A.D., that's say 500 years after the Buddha's time, a new order of Buddhism comes into form in northwest India. It is the Buddhism known as the Mahayana, the big or great ferry boat Buddhism. Now, to explain the difference between the two, I'm going to use a little anecdote that my friend of long ago, Heinrich Zimmer, once proposed. The Bay Area, with San Francisco on this side, and over there across the bay, Berkeley, with all the wise men there. So you're fed up with San Francisco. You're absolutely in disgust of life. And you've heard about Berkeley. You've heard about Nirvana. And you've heard what a peaceful, wonderful place it is, and what spiritual life there is over there. So you go down to the shore and you keep look day after day over at Berkeley. This is the desire for the experience, you know, of Nirvana. One fine day, a ferry boat sets out from the yonder shore, comes right to your feet. And in the ferry boat, there is a man who says, "Anyone for Berkeley?" And you say, "Aye." And he says, "Get aboard." But there's a consideration. Namely, this is a one-way trip. Now, the texts say, unless you are as eager for nirvanic bliss as a man whose hair is on fire would be for a pond into which to dive, don't start. It's too tough. So you get in the boat, and the boat starts out, and you have a pang. You think, mother, or something like that. But it's too late now, and you're out in the water. And now it's ship ahoy. The splash of the waves on the hull of the boat. You thought it was going to be a short trip. It may take six incarnations. You're now a monk. And it's such a real relief and pleasure, counting the beads in this hand and then over here, putting little flowers on altars and so forth. Life has been reduced to such simplicities that there's nothing, no problems at all. The last thing you want now is to get ashore on the other shore where something else might happen. One fine incarnation or another, the boat scrapes ashore. This is that moment of rapture, you know. But you can't live in that. We're there. So you get ashore. It's a new life, a new breeze, and all that sort of thing. And then you think, well, I wonder how San Francisco looks from here. Now we're going to move into the other kind of Buddhism. This has been Hinayana Buddhism. Only those willing to give up everything, monks and nuns and so forth, and to play the little game of rosaries and flowers, they can get onto this trip. I wonder what San Francisco looks like from here. Forgetting that you're in the realm beyond pairs of opposites. Turn around this. No San Francisco. There's no bay between. There's no ferry boat. There's no Buddha. This is it. This is known as the Mahayana. We're all there. And who's there? Well, the first doctrine of Buddhism is Anatman. All things are without a self. So who's on the boat anyhow? Didn't you realize that? We are all simply illusions of a consciousness that is the real ground. This is the illusion that comes with the rippling waters of a pond. Broken images that come and go. We identified ourselves with one of those that comes and goes. That was when we were in San Francisco. Now we have identified ourselves with the Buddha consciousness, which informs all things, and we're at peace. We can open our eyes and return to the world. We're in San Francisco. You see what we get? So this is known as the Buddhism of the Great Delight, Mahasukha. All is sorrowful and in perfect rapture. And that night, the Buddha comes to illumination, facing the east, and the new rising sun beholds him as a Buddha. He sat there so stunned with what he had experienced that he did not move for 7 days. And while he sat there was a terrific storm of the universe that threatened him. And the serpent king, Buchalinda, who supports the universe from beneath and was right beneath that immovable spot himself, the serpent supporting the world, he came up and enwrapped the Buddha with his body and his serpent hoods over the Buddha's head so he was protected from the storm. And what it shows is that the Savior, who represents the culmination of consciousness, is in accord with the serpent power of the universe. The tempter came to the Buddha in two forms, one in the form of karma, desire, the other in the form of mara, the fear, the terror of death. The gods come down and they say, for the good of mankind and the gods and the universe, please teach. And the Buddha says, I will. But what he teaches is not Buddhism. It is the way to Buddhism. So Buddhism is called a yana, a vehicle, a ferry boat. And it's a ferry boat that carries you from this shore of pain and pleasure, birth and death, pairs of opposites, across the water of the vortices of life to the yonder shore beyond duality. The ego, desires, and fears. Transcendence of these is the passage through the gate to the temple. You have to pass through fear and desire to get to the Buddha, whose hand says, don't be afraid of those two chaps. Come on. the mysteries of Eleusis, this wonderful shrine just outside of Athens, which was the sacred spot for the Athenian population, has a background way into the Bronze Age. And it survived then in the classical world through Roman times until the conversion of the Roman Empire into a Christian empire. Christianity was declared to be the only permitted religion in the Roman Empire. And so a system of violent persecution and vandalism begins. The destruction of shrines, and the more sacred the shrine, the more violent the destruction. Meanwhile, however, in the Hellenistic period, many of the earlier mystery cults had come back into manifestation. There's something in the way of a revelation was actually experienced there. And it's my belief that the great insight that St. Paul had on the road to Damascus was that the death of Christ, of Jesus, on the cross could be interpreted in terms of the classical mystery religions of the death and resurrection of the Savior. The death to one's purely material animal existence and the birth then of the spiritual life. And here are the two great goddesses. This is Demeter. And here is her daughter, Persephone, who is the one who dies and is resurrected. And this is the sacred cave out of which Hades came, or Pluto, to abduct Persephone. So this is an old, old story. In the Greek, the demon is that unconscious impulse that is the dynamic of your life and which comes to you in vision and dream. But in the Christian interpretation, it's a devil. All that a devil is a repressed demon, one who has not been recognized, one who has not been given his due, has been not allowed to play into your life and so becomes a violent threat. This is the beautiful Olympian Apollo, who represents protection and represents the consciousness and light. The radiance, the vis of the Apollonian mind moves everywhere the muses. This is Dionysos, the vine, wine, drunkenness, who represents the dynamic of the unconscious. From below consciousness, he comes singing forth. And the wonderful thing in the Greek world is they are in accord. Dionysos is admitted to Olympus. though the Dionysian shatters. Dionysos is the energy that shatters in order to bring forth. Anything that is going to be created involves the shattering of what was there before it. What the Christ came down into the world for the shattering, for the shattering, the shattering. This beautiful Maenad, snakes in her hair, going to tear a leopard apart. With the thyrsos here, symbolic of the sap, the vegetable flow of life, uncontrolled by reason, just the dynamic of nature. Here is Orpheus torn apart, as Jesus was torn apart in the scourging and crucifixion. The eternity is in love with the forms of time. But to come into those forms, it has to be dismembered. And then you, as a separate entity in the form of time, in order to lose your commitment to this little instance, you must be dismembered and opened to the transcendent. Orpheus, Bacchus, crucified. And he goes to the cross like a bridegroom to the bride. And you have the death and resurrection motif of the moon. All you have to do is spend a little while with these things. And they sing to you. I'll never forget the experience of going to Delphi in Greece. The temples have all been deliberately smashed by the vandalism of the Christians. But they're still there, and you can see what the Greek idea of corporal beauty was. There is then the oracle where the Pythoness, the prophetess, received the inspiration from the fumes, the smoke coming up from the abyss, and prophesied and gave statements of destiny. And then you have up on another level this beautiful theater with the whole wonderful valley and landscape as its backdrop. And that accord with nature, and the bringing of nature to its high fulfillment in human nature. This is Greek. It's this idea of the individual, an individual quest. And of course, the great symbolic moment in the Greeks' own understanding of this matter was the great battle of Marathon, where the Persian slave civilization, you might say, they had conquered everything in Asia, from the Ionian Isles to the Indus River, including all the world of the ancients, Mesopotamia, Egypt, and all. And the Greeks stopped them. A few Years later, Alexander the Great goes smashing through the whole Persian Empire, a young man in his early 20s. With the idea of a self-directed, not overmastered field of action. But here we have the two traditions in Europe. One, you might say, the heroic one, which is the native one of Europe, going back to the old Germanic, Celtic spirit, and then the applied Christian one, which is brought in from the Near East. By the 11th and 12th centuries, Europe is beginning to assimilate this material. And the Grail story, the Arthurian romances, represent this assimilation. The theme of the Grail is the bringing of life into what is known as the wasteland. The wasteland is the preliminary theme to which the Grail is the answer. What is the sense of the wasteland? It's the world of people living inauthentic lives. If there is a path, it is someone else's path, and you are not on the adventure. Each entered the forest at a point that he himself had chosen, where it was darkest and there was no path. Now, who can see and enter the castle of the Grail? Not everybody. Only those with a spiritual readiness for the experience. The sword represents the virtue. The sword represents the energy. It has come to Arthur from the abyss. This is the world of the unconscious, the world of the gods, the goddess who informs all things. Arthur, Artehe, was revered as a god. He's originally a Celtic god. And the name Artus, Arthur, is related to Artemis, Arcturus. All of these are related to the deity, the bear. And the bear is the oldest worshipped deity in the world. We have bear shrines going back to Neanderthal times in just this part of the world from perhaps 100,000 BC. The fantastic tradition and the levels and levels of culture that have piled up in Europe, which is the, not the youngest, it's the oldest culture in the world. The Celts come into Europe in the first millennium BC. They come from Bavaria, across France, Switzerland, and into the British Isles. Now, the people who had been in Europe before were pre-Celtic, pre-Indo-European. And their tradition may go back all the way to the caves. But the great period of their flowering is that of Stonehenge.